The following program is presented for a blind and print-impaired audience. It's John Fetterson with Indie Week. Publication date of Indie Week is April the 20th of 2023. And as usual, we alternate between IndieWeek.com and the print edition, which was put out to press yesterday. And so there are more complete, up-to-date articles in the often available online. And I will start with one of those. Joe Killian writes, drag performance. A new bill would criminalize public drag performances. They could become illegal under a bill filed Tuesday in the House of Representatives. H-673 would classify as adult live entertainment any, quote, male or female impersonators who provide entertainment that appeals to a prurient interest, making it illegal for drag performances to take place on public property in the presence of anyone under age 18. The bill, filed by State Representative Jeff Zenger Forsyth, does not define prurient interest. That phrase has been heavily legally debated in the U.S. for decades, but generally refers to materials or performances that inspire sexual thoughts. The bill specifies that it's immaterial whether the performance is for consideration, meaning that there would be no distinction between paid and free performances. The bill places drag in a category with, according to the text, topless dancers, exotic dancers, strippers, and makes a first offense a Class A1 misdemeanor and a second offense a Class 1 felony. The bill is part of a national wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation, including bills that would criminalize drag filed in at least 16 states so far this year. Last month, Tennessee became the first state to pass such a bill into law, though a federal judge in Memphis temporarily blocked it earlier this month, saying it was vague and overly broad in its restriction of speech. In North Carolina, Republicans have taken aim at drag performances in private business and public spaces like libraries. Last year, Newsline reported on Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, the highest elected Republican in the state, bemoaning that more Christians are not willing to threaten assault to enforce their religious principles in public spaces. He said at a church event in October, "No longer is a Christian willing to grab that whip and walk into the public library and tell them, 'In this library, you will not use my tax dollars to promote sin to these children, and if I have to come here and tear these books out myself and run that drag queen out of here myself, I will.'" Protests and threats against libraries for carrying books and holding events to which conservatives object are also on the rise the last few years. One group taking the steps Robinson suggests, neo-Nazis. Last July, about 20 members of a neo-Nazi group in Boston mounted just such a library protest, leading to the arrest of their leader. Closer to home, the Forsyth County Republican Men's Club protested a drag queen storytime event last June, not at a public library, but at Bookmarks, a privately owned independent bookstore in Winston-Salem. Messages promoting the protest called it perversion, and the chairman of the county GOP called it the work of militant gay leftists trying to separate children from their parents. The incident, an assault on the right of private businesses and their customers to peaceably hold legal events on their own property, was the sort of escalation the Southern Poverty Law Center has documented and explored through recent studies on the rise of extremism in America. Kendra Johnson, executive director of LGBTQ advocacy group Equality NC, "We knew it was coming." At the time, Johnson and other advocates from across the state were in the Tuesday morning hearing on Senate 631, which would prohibit transgender students from playing on school teams for the gender with which they identify, codifying that, quote, "a student's sex shall be recognized based solely on the student's reproductive biology and genetics at birth." Both bills are a part of a raft of new LGBTQ legislation filed this session. Their passage appears to have been made more likely by the defection of Representative Tricia Cotham from the Democratic Party to the GOP, giving Republicans a veto-proof supermajority in both House and Senate. In a statement Tuesday afternoon, Johnson condemned that bill as a discriminatory and undemocratic attack on our most fundamental rights. Attacks on drag, said Johnson, shows aim to stop LGBTQ people from being who we are and expressing ourselves freely. Drag bans are part of broader attacks on queer and transgender people, alongside coordinated efforts to police gender expression. Drag performances are one of many diverse art forms that the LGBTQ community has contributed to American culture, and this form of expression should be protected under the First Amendment. This is very closely connected to another article in Indy Week, also about a state House vote, which voted 73-39 to pass a bill which expands the originally proposed ban about female athletes from female sports teams, barring transgender females. This bill proposed not only middle and high school teams, but it was to include college athletes, and moved swiftly through two committees to a floor vote in the afternoon. And that vote now heads to the Senate, which heard its own version of the bill this week. A final version of that measure could be the first in a series of anti-LGBTQ measures to make their way to Governor Roy Cooper's desk, facilitated by Tricia Cotham's party switch earlier this month that gave Republicans a veto-proof supermajority. Cotham, once a champion of LGBTQ rights, who received Equality NC's Legislative Leadership Award in 2013, voted for that ban. 21 other states have passed comparable bans in a national wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation that includes restrictions on transgender health care to criminalizing drag performances. I'll move to a more local Durham-based article by Savannah Wen. Mayor Elaine O'Neill presented a vibrant snapshot of the Bull City in her State of the City address on Monday, even while lamenting the city's wave of gun violence. O'Neill noted that the city's most recent resident satisfaction survey, 82% of residents felt Durham was an excellent place to live. In the same survey, 78% responded that Durham was an excellent or good place to work. "Now that's clap-worthy right there," the mayor said. The crowd promptly applauded. There were other clap-worthy moments. O'Neill touted a federal grant of over $10 million disbursed to Durham through the recently signed bipartisan infrastructure law, which will fund upgrades to public transit. She also announced that four affordable housing projects currently under consideration could bring 400 units to the Bull City. The city has also made strides towards supporting more small and minority-owned businesses, and through its Youth Works program has connected over 700 young people with local internships and jobs. She said, "Business partners, these bright lights represent your future and our future workforce. Please, this summer, summer's coming, give them the opportunity to realize their career goals, and you too will reap the benefits of a skilled talent pipeline that guarantees our success." Yet, O'Neill devoted much of the speech to addressing Durham's struggle with gun violence. The issue carried particular weight in the wake of multiple shootings in the past week. Some 18 juveniles have been shot in Durham this year. Quote, "I have to acknowledge the senseless violence that continues to plague our city and cities all across this great nation. Each person taken away from our community continues to tear holes in the very fabric of who we are," said O'Neill. City Hall fell still as attendees observed a moment of silence. The mayor stressed the urgency of addressing the root causes of violence, including poverty, and praised the work of violence prevention groups such as Bull City United. She also highlighted the city's new crisis response pilot known as HEART. By embedding mental health clinicians into the 9/11 call center, and deploying unarmed crisis responders to respond to calls, this model emphasizes a nonviolent approach to reducing crime. O'Neill also touched on Durham's ongoing battle against housing insecurity, highlighting the work of a 12-member task force that is examining barriers to housing in the Bull City. Results should be announced by the end of the year, she said, before returning to the city's most pressing issue. As she recounted a family member's brush with gun violence the day before, O'Neill pleaded, "Let's not let anyone else's child have to die on the streets of Durham, North Carolina. We have to figure out why our young people are killing each other, and we're going to have to take ownership of that. You cannot be afraid of the streets of Durham." She implored Durhamites watching the address to take on active roles in their communities. "You have to help us," she said. "You cannot expect your government to do it all. A lot of times we react to an incident. It has to come from our neighbors and from within the community. So I encourage you tonight to think about how you are going to help make these streets of Durham safe for all of us to live, work, and play. Bull City strong, everybody." Next, moving to the print edition of Indy Week, we know that Earth Day is a national day of interest, and maybe worldwide, about ecology, and there are several articles in the Indy Week pertaining to Earth. And first, from Tomasi McDonald, "The Ecology, How Climate Change Will Impact North Carolina and the Triangle." "The dismal reality of more destructive flooding, wildfires, tornadoes, and hurricanes, along with melting glaciers, the extinction of plant and animal species, and limited water supplies across the globe has been well documented. It's Earth Day week. Maybe it's time to ponder what climate change's impact has been here in the Triangle. How bad is it?" Indy spoke with several climate change scholars at NC State, NC Central, and Duke University to better understand, with a nod to Marvin Gaye, the first person I ever heard mention ecology, what's going on here in the Bull City and beyond. The academicians offered up a mix of history, marginalization and access to resources, the impact of population growth and development that degrades wildlife zones, the deadly threat of increasing temperatures, and the arrival of invasive plant species. But they also pointed to hope by way of activism and solutions via science, along with collaborative agreements and partnerships, all augmented by practical, common-sense habits we can all practice toward achieving the goal of preventing this planet from becoming an intermediary chamber of hell. Ashley Ward is Senior Policy Associate with Duke University's Nicholas Institute for Energy, Environment, and Sustainability. Her area of expertise is climate health resilience, with a focus on extreme heat. Ward tells Indy, "Heat kills more people than any other weather-related event for the last 30 years, more than twice as many as floods, more than hurricanes, tornadoes, and lightning strikes combined. This is how severe it is, and it's 100% preventable." Ward, along with the other scholars who spoke with Indy, says while the climate crisis affects everyone, marginalized communities with limited resources are disproportionately affected. She points to the impact extreme heat has on residents who live in historically underfunded communities in the Triangle, including public housing and certain neighborhoods where people are more vulnerable to heat, particularly if they have underlying chronic medical conditions like high blood pressure or diabetes. Ward says it's called energy poverty. It's not sufficient to say there's air conditioning in the house if you can't afford to run it. Some people are having to make the difficult decision of buying their medicine and not running their air conditioner. It's not just, do you have air conditioning? It's also, can you afford to run it? Ward also points to workplace risks posed by extreme heat and added that the threat is not only for people who work outside. It's not just folks working in cucumber fields, she says. It's all of us. She explains that in parts of eastern North Carolina, there have been reports of employee workplaces where temperatures reach up to 90 degrees. When the workday ends, those employees return to homes without air conditioning during nights that now experience higher temperatures. Quote, the body doesn't have a chance to recover from the heat and starts the next workday at a deficit. Predictably, hospital emergency room visits spike in the middle of the week. It's not just how hot it is in this area, but also the persistently high temperatures at night that factor in to create the perfect storm that's happening. The body just can't recover. John J. Bang is a professor of environmental, earth, and geospatial sciences at NC Central. Part of his research includes assessing communities' exposure to air and water pollutants from a health disparities perspective. Bang tells the Indy, it's obvious that climate change will have a greater impact on people with fewer resources. Quote, historically, it's always been that way when you look at this country. Bang adds, this is the case both here in America and globally. Here in the Triangle, the big concerns with climate change are food deserts, along with water and air quality. The professor points to a fast-growing population and overdevelopment, with the consequence of cutting down trees to make room for more buildings. There's also an increase in transportation and fossil fuel emissions that affect air quality. He says, before overdevelopment, water quality was going down. He points to the increased use of water for construction as well as to meet the needs of a growing population. And he explains that with increased usage by a growing population, prices go up and marginalized communities are disproportionately impacted economically and medically. He says, Research Triangle Park is one of the fastest growing regions in the country. If you're part of a community with a low socioeconomic status, it's not hard to predict more burdens for that group. He says, historically, people with more resources are able to cope with the stresses coming up. For example, they may use a water filtration system on their faucet, and they're less likely to be affected by climate change and all other stresses. But he emphasizes that regardless of your status, we all need to use tap water on some level for showers and cooking, and we all breathe the same air. Meanwhile, Kofi Boone, professor of landscape architecture at NC State University, offers a historical perspective on why Black Americans and other people of color are disproportionately affected by climate change in the Triangle, the southeastern part of the United States, and across the globe. Boone says the region is experiencing unprecedented flooding from rainstorms and hurricanes. Soon after Hurricane Matthew devastated eastern North Carolina in 2016, Boone was among a cadre of researchers who participated in a statewide program to assist counties in the state that were wrecked by Matthews. He points to Princeville, the first all-black town in North Carolina, founded by formerly enslaved people in 1865. The town is prone to flooding because it was built on a floodplain that serves as an escape valve for waters from the Tar River until it recedes. Boone says the development of a great many early African American communities was relegated to the least desirable low-lying areas. But he also points to another reason why the settlers of Princeville in 1865 chose to build the town on a floodplain. He explains it was built out of necessity, close to the Union Army after the Civil War, to feel safe. He adds that this phenomenon has occurred across the southeastern United States, and scholars have coined the term racialized topography to describe it. Boone points to communities in southeast Raleigh that mirror the flooding in Princeville. Biltmore Hills and Rochester Heights were built along the Walnut Creek watershed. The neighborhoods were the first subdivisions in Raleigh built on black-owned land beginning in the late 1950s. The professor says the Southeast Raleigh neighborhoods and Princeville share a same similar story. He says they have the same history, the same hardships. The land was bought during Reconstruction. They built a community, and now natural disasters lead to questions about how to fix it, how to conserve it. Boone offers a different perspective on the population growth and development across the triangle, the threat to wildlife zones, where indigenous plants thrive and animals breed and build their nests. He points to the Ellerbee Creek in North Durham that stretches from Bragtown to Jordan Lake, which flows into the Neuse River before going into the Atlantic Ocean. The schools, businesses, farms, and homes that are built along the Ellerbee Creek watershed may be good for people, Boone says, but harm the environment where plants and species need to survive. Quote, there are a bunch of tadpoles in Ellerbee Creek, but the zones where they live are getting smaller and smaller. There's a realization that animals move where they're supposed to go. An example is all the fish, birds, and amphibians that move along that creek for food, to build their nests, and to hunt. Boone says more concerted effort to conserve the wildlife zone would bolster the chances of survival of the great blue heron, a large wading bird that is the symbol of the Ellerbee Creek Watershed Association. Boone says Ellerbee Creek is one of the few places in the United States where these birds breed, build their nests, and have their babies. It's really special, he adds. He says the warming temperatures are also causing another phenomenon. Plants that grow farther south in North Carolina and Georgia are now appearing in North Carolina. They're creeping up and pushing out the natural plant species that can't take the heat, he says. The top three climate threats in the triangle, he says, are access to quality drinking water, the loss of natural habitats due to destruction caused by human development, storms, and drought, and public health and the treatment of diseases that are expected to move south. Those are the big ones we have to worry about, he says. That and black people and other marginalized groups already at high risk who are last in line to get resources to protect our communities. Still, in the face of such a dire situation, the climate crisis forecast is not all gloom and doom. Science and technology are trying to meet the challenge of addressing climate change. Engineers in Orange County, California, are making that region drought resilient by relying on a process that includes microfiltration and reverse osmosis to transform wastewater into drinking water. Bang with NC Central says nanotechnology is being used to remove pollutants from water and air. And Ward with Duke points to the need for North Carolina to adopt the national cooling standard some states already have in use. Quote, there are heating standards, but we don't have cooling standards in North Carolina. Boone points to a group of activists in Southeast Raleigh working to address flooding in Biltmore Hills and Rochester Heights, where streets are named after famous African Americans. The community's activism was ignited by Hurricane Floyd in 1999 when Walnut Creek flooded and devastated the historic neighborhoods. What followed was the creation of the Walnut Creek Wetland Center, which educates its visitors about the importance of wetlands for clean water, habitat, and recreation, while emphasizing the importance of human interaction with nature, according to its website. Along with technology, activism, and education, the scholars say that all of us can take common sense actions that will contribute to the future well-being of a planet bedeviled by frequent, often deadly weather disasters, and other climate out-of-order stresses. Take cool showers after work, Ward says, or immerse your feet in a cool tub of water. Place a wet cheesecloth on your fan at night to cool the air if you don't have an air conditioner, she adds. Bang says take shorter showers. Recycle. Plant trees. The NC's Central Scholar says he's gotten into the habit of giving trees away. I started about 6 years ago, he said. Conservation is something we can all do, or something we cannot all do. Do not do is a terrible mistake. At the beginning, middle, and end of life on Earth, climate change affects us all. A tornado bearing down in a farmhouse, the sun's extreme heat causing a high school athlete to die from heat exhaustion, or a raging wildfire consuming your home does not consider race, class, ethnicity, religion, education, or political affiliation. All three scholars say the challenge for Triangle residents and beyond, seeing the big picture. Bang. People are busy living their everyday lives, and they can't see it on a global scale. Climate change is something happening in other places. When people understand, it will make a big difference in how they live and how they drive. Ward agrees and encourages more urban tree planting to cool temperatures, but she says the federal government has a decisive role in mitigating the adverse effects of extreme heat. The difference, she says, will determine when children can play outside and the health impact on patrons at bus stops and pedestrians. Quote, when we have livable communities with clean air and a cool environment, people in those neighborhoods will have better individual health outcomes and well-being. And Boone quotes, people have to see themselves as part of the world and invest in its stewardship. Explore making a good start in your own community, he adds. We're trying to inspire people. Well, moving on to another Earth Day-related article. Trash talk, Jasmine Gallup writes. Conspiracy theories are for right-wing nuts and doomsday preppers, or so I thought. But a few months ago, I started hearing whispers among my liberal family and friends. Recycling, they alleged, was a myth. It wasn't really happening, or it wasn't really doing any good, according to rumors. A lot of people I knew, a surprising number, speculated that Raleigh was collecting plastic bottles, aluminum cans, and cardboard, only to throw them in a landfill. One Reddit user, items in Raleigh are restricted because nothing else is getting recycled, and even those really aren't in the U.S. Plastic recycling is a myth. Comments piled up on this post. Most recyclable plastics are burned or dumped in the ocean, Raleigh residents said. We used to ship them to China, but can't anymore, they added. Plastic recycling is, quote, a lie from the plastic industry. Another Raleighite wrote, I wish more people knew this. To be fair, I only learned about wish-cycling recently. Those recycle symbols they print on plastics don't mean much. It's like companies that put green or eco in their name. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. This is a conspiracy theory that's been circulating in the United States for years, and it's rooted in real facts. As of 2018, only about 8.7% of the 35.7 million tons of plastic generated by the United States was recycled, according to the EPA. In the past few years, news outlets looking into this phenomenon have reported that not only is plastic exorbitantly expensive to recycle, but it can also be reused only once or twice before degrading. With little demand for used plastic products in the global recycling market, most plastic products are incinerated or tossed in landfills. According to the EPA, 32.6 million tons in 2018. The plastic recycling industry was put under additional pressure in 2018 when China which had been buying more than half the world's used plastic, raised its standards for plastic products and stopped accepting most items. Suddenly, cities like Raleigh were scrambling to find a buyer for used plastic, only to find that no one wanted it. Cities and towns were forced to cough up thousands or millions of dollars to continue local recycling programs. In many cases, the additional cost was passed on to residents in the form of higher monthly fees. Raleigh managed to avoid raising monthly recycling fees in 2019 by covering the additional $1.5 million cost of its program with money from the general fund. But recycling still costs more today than it did back then. In 2019, back then. Then, Raleigh's monthly recycling fee was $2.60 per month. In 2020, it's almost double, $4.60 per month. Today, some people feel betrayed by recycling. They were told, in many cases by the multi-million dollar companies that were producing the most plastic, that it was an all-purpose bomb for the environment. Worried about global warming? Don't worry, just recycle. In recent years, however, it's become apparent that recycling is a very specific, limited process that has been hampered by a shrinking global market. Samantha Timpson, who was out with her family last week at a North Raleigh park, says, I think recycling certain things like aluminum cans is helpful. I'm like, okay, this is actually being used for something. But certain things, I'm like, I don't really know. I just try not to buy things that are plastic to begin with. Timpson's take is an accurate one. In the world of recycling, plastics are one of the least valuable materials. In North Carolina, PET plastic, that's the kind found in disposable water bottles and peanut butter jars, sells for about 14 cents a pound. Colored HDPE plastic, that's the kind found in milk jugs, shampoo bottles, and juice cartons, sells for about 13 cents per pound. Other plastics, like PP plastics, found in bottle caps and yogurt containers, are essentially worthless. Aluminum, on the other hand, is worth its weight in U.S. dollars. Loose aluminum cans sell for about 79 cents a pound. Other materials like clear glass, 2 cents, office paper, 11 cents, and steel cans, 8 cents, are less in demand, but can be more recycled more times than plastic. Maine Johnson, who is a spokesperson for Raleigh's Solid Waste Service Department, says, there's often a perception that, okay, something is metal, I can recycle it. But people don't understand that a lot of things are based on marketability and the demand for that item. Ultimately, recycling is a mixed bag, especially when it comes to plastic. Only a few types of plastic are really recyclable, primarily PET and HDPE. Other single-use plastics like go-to utensils, straws, cups, styrofoam takeout containers can't be processed by recycling plants. But even though recycling plastic is inefficient, it's not pointless. North Carolina has a high demand for PET, HDPE, and PP plastics, says Melody Foote, a spokesperson for the NC Department of Environmental Quality. There are at least 4 local companies that use these products, including ClearPath Recycling, which recycles PET, Unify Manufacturing, which turns PET into yarn, Polywood, which turns HDPE into furniture, and Envision, which recycles HDPE and PP plastic. Plastic bags, films, and wraps, which are typically not recyclable, are also in demand by 2 nearby companies, Foote says. These items should not go in your recycling bin, but can be turned in for reuse at grocery stores, where they may be sent to Fiberon in North Carolina, or Trex in Virginia, to be turned into plastic lumber and outdoor furniture. Ultimately, though, About 80% of what you put in your recycling bin will be reused at least once, according to local processing plant Sonoco. The other 20% usually consist of non-recyclable items like clothing or batteries that end up in the landfill. The good news is that of those recyclables, the majority stays in the southeastern United States as opposed to being shipped overseas. In 2020, about 34% of recyclables went to companies in North Carolina, 22% to South Carolina, 24% to other southeastern states, and 7% to other states across the country. Only about 13% of recyclables that year were exported to companies outside the United States, according to Foote. So, is recycling worth it? That's up to you. Tracy Hinton, a North Raleigh nurse, remains frustrated with the process, she says. She wrote in an email to Indy, I recycle everything I can, but it seems like a drop in the bucket. There was so much waste at the hospital. Every patient gets their meds and drinks in a plastic cup, and they all go into the garbage every time. With all that waste, Hinton remains skeptical of recycling. I've taken things to the dump that should have gone in the recycling bin. I wonder what really happens to all these things I put in my container. Still, some people argue that recycling some materials is better than not recycling at all, Johnson says. Recycling does slow down the negative effects of waste that accumulate in our landfills. Being conscious of how you recycle is going to be much better than discarding everything in the trash can. But at the same time, recycling is only one small piece of the environmental puzzle. Reducing the amount of waste you produce and reusing what you can are two other major components of caring for the earth. Timson, the woman who tries not to buy plastic goods, has the right idea, but she thinks about recycling more than most. Other neighbors I spoke with last week didn't seem to give much thought to recycling beyond simply doing it when it was convenient. My family and friends regularly use their recycling bins, sometimes to the point of filling them up, but usually don't consider taking other steps to reduce landfill waste. The bottom line, saving our natural environment requires some inconvenience. It might be easier to drive 10 blocks to a friend's house, but cycling doesn't release greenhouse gases. It's simpler to shop online, but shopping in the store doesn't result in tons of non-recyclable packaging. It is convenient to put groceries in plastic bags, but reusable totes don't end up in landfills. Johnson says, we know for a fact the less items go into the landfill, the better the outcome is for everyone. But if you view our environment as a valuable commodity, people should consider how they not only dispose of items, but how they purchase items, the reusable factor. I think, for the most part, everyone wants to be a good steward of the environment. Often it's just a matter of doing a little digging to find out what little things can be done to improve the situation for everybody. It's not one person's burden, it's everyone's burden to make sure that we preserve the environment, the community, and the planet. Now, the third Earth Day article in the Indie Week is a little bit off the beaten path, but it concerns what to do with dead bodies. And it's an interview with Hunter Beatty. Jasmine Gallup of Indie Week concluded. How did you get into the business of aquamation? And Hunter Beatty responds, in my 20s, I was doing a lot of renewable energy work, then kind of fell off the path from that. I was trying to come back to service work and just didn't know how that could happen. Then I read about Desmond Tutu, former Archbishop of Cape Town, choosing aquamation in January of 2022. I was completely inspired by his decision and also the compelling case all of those articles made that modern funeral practices are not sustainable and are bad for the environment. How do current funeral practices harm the environment? Our cemeteries are filling up. We can't keep preserving dead bodies, putting them in non-biodegradable caskets in the middle of town, taking up public space, space that could otherwise be open for wildlife or used for affordable housing. We have two amazing options in front of us. One is green burial at conservation cemeteries, and the other, aquamation, which is, of course, a better option than traditional cremation, because we're not combusting the body and releasing greenhouse gases and carcinogenic gases into the atmosphere. What exactly is aquamation? Both flame cremation and water cremation accomplish the same goal. They remove the soft tissue so bone remains in the form of calcium phosphate. Bone dust can be returned to the family in an urn. Flame cremation uses 1,700 degree temperatures to combust this soft tissue. And that's how nitrous oxide, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and carcinogenic gases are released. As an alternative, aquamation circulates an alkaline solution around the body, 95% water, 5% potassium hydroxide. The process is called alkaline hydrolysis. Essentially, fats, carbohydrates, and proteins are broken down into sugars, salts, amino acids, and peptides. Those are the building blocks of the soft tissue in our body. That's then filtered and treated at a wastewater facility, again as an alternative to combusting it and it going up into the air. Then the bone remains are returned to the family. What response do people have to the idea of aquamation? The initial reaction is a little bit of squeamishness because they think, oh my gosh, you're liquefying a body. But I think we all have this natural tendency to scrutinize something that's new and different. Once I explain the process to them, most people are sold on it. They think it's a gentler process on the body. We return more bone remains. We don't lose any up through the chimney. So it's a more delicate process. And then, of course, there are the environmental benefits. What are the environmental benefits? By not combusting the body, we're not releasing all those gases and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The process uses about one-tenth of the energy as flame cremation. And that, of course, flame cremation uses natural gas, a fossil fuel. We are using electricity, most of which is generated from a coal-fired power plant right now. However, once we have our solar array over our parking lot, we will be completely carbon neutral. We'll be able to offset the electricity usage from all of our aquamation. That's our goal for 2024. Aquamation is part of the larger green burial movement, even though it doesn't involve burial. We're thinking end-of-life care. In terms of conservation cemeteries and aquamation, North Carolina is up there with California in terms of having all these incredible options. How do you feel about being in the funeral business? If you'd have asked me a year and a half ago what I wanted to do with my life, I can't imagine anything that would have been lower on the list than death care. Working with dead bodies, it's a difficult process and is gross. But the front of the house operation, interacting with the community, this is such a profoundly meaningful experience. To work with people in end-of-life care, to overlap with someone when they're preparing for their imminent death or they're grieving the loss of a loved one. We just spoke at Duke Divinity School. We're hosting monthly death cafes at the Urn Gallery. We live in a death-denying society, so this is an opportunity for people to be very open and talk about their fears, concerns, just share information with other people about end-of-life matters. And finally, why is it important to talk about death? And Hunter Beatty replies, things can happen at a moment's notice, and it's important for people to be prepared and start talking about these issues now. I mean, we all share this experience. We will lose a loved one. We will ultimately die, and at some point, we have to consider end-of-life options. Well, now I have about 12 minutes remaining, and I'll choose to go to a music article in Indie Week. And this is titled, Musician Seeking Tiny Desk Job. It's by Grant Holub-Moorman. Over 100 independent musicians from North Carolina submitted to NPR Music's Tiny Desk Contest this year. Phone propped on a shelf, we're looking over the drummer's shoulder at lead singer Valencia Giles, flanked by bandmates on both sides. She greets the viewer, both hands up, with a reverb-laden, "Hi!" The band cracks up. NPR's Music's Tiny Desk Contest is beautiful for its lack of polish. Giles, a Garner singer-songwriter who performs as Lindsay, submitted a video for the first time this year. Entry requirements are straightforward: a performance of an original song with a desk featured somewhere in the video. The annual competition is an open call for unsigned artists that offers a single golden ticket to the highest throne of indie music, a performance by a cluttered desk, and exposure on a YouTube channel with 7 million subscribers. This year's winner, coming up, it will be announced on May the 9th. The Tiny Desk bookshelf backdrop is a collage of mugs, stuffed animals, an Emmy, and sounds of the rainforest smoke alarm. Despite the maximalism, Tiny Desk wants the cramped stage to encourage simplicity. Behind this desk, T-Pain sang without autotune. Mitski played solo, howling into her guitar. For Giles, the open call merited a shoulder shrug, sure, after Jupierre, her collaborator in Atlanta, urged her to enter with a hodgepodge group of other underground artists. Giles figured it wouldn't be too much work and it might be a good way to build a network. Beyond exposure, the contest emphasizes a community of independent artists that celebrate and support each other. Last year's winner, bilingual singer-songwriter Alicia Amador, wrote on NPR, "I entered every year for 5 years because it always introduced me to fantastic artists. It reminded me that I actually wasn't alone." Growing up in Garner, Giles found her voice at Lucky Tree. That's a Raleigh cafe with open mics and performances in a myriad of genres. The supportive community helped Giles find her own unique country style as a teenager. She says, "There's this stigma that country music is a white thing." That style flows subtly in her contest entry, Mistakes of Youth, with her bandmates carrying an R&B groove that alternately lurches and sways. It's a blend that just might be the thing to catch the ear of NPR music producer Bobby Carter, who, in an email interview, gives a shout-out to Charlotte's Anthony Hamilton before doubling down on his love of Southern music. And he tells Indie Week, "These young musicians are coming to the table with a gumbo of styles and submitting entries that are impossible to classify, and I love it. I've seen R&B singers over bluegrass and country rhythms." For her submission, Giles was joined by pianist Jupierre, Don Chi on guitar, Xavier Jones on bass, and Caleb Lanier on drums. Despite just a phone handling the audio mix, the group is synchronized through hard breaks and twisting transitions, the instruments weaving into the foreground. For some musicians, the Tiny Desk Contest is a long-awaited boost. That was the case for the first year's winner, Oakland, California's Fantastic Negrito. The seasoned black roots artist was striving to return to music after a 7-year hiatus. After winning the award from NPR in 2014, he went on to win 3 album Grammys. Rani and Rosa Russ, who also submitted to the 2023 contest, are now in their third decade of professional music. They perform as Sultry Storm, formerly Duete. The sisters live in Raleigh and Clemens, respectively. After years of full-time gigging in New York City, Rosa started a publishing company and moved down to North Carolina in 2001, but she refused to abandon the craft. The entire Russ family is musical. Their mother was a touring opera and Broadway performer. So after years of watching the curated Tiny Desk concerts, the Russ sisters learned about their chance to perform on the cramped stage. They booked it back to New York City to record I See You with collaborators Sean Lucas, Dave Innes, Eric Brown, and Sly Scott. The story is an uplifting acknowledgement of struggle and survival. Rosa says, a lot of people don't get accolades for everyday living and just doing what you got to do to survive. I just think people need to hear that we see you, we appreciate you. That invitational love is present in Sultry Storm's lyrics, originally written in 2012, and in the block party dance moves that the pair break out during the entry video. As the lead singer, Rosa glides easily between delightful jazz trills and pointed soul melodies. Rani coolly harmonizes before launching into rap verses. Relying on classic rhythms from the early New York City hip-hop scene, Rani questions the people who allow the struggle to become them. Why you gotta be? You versus this economy. Got you on your knees. Is that a prophecy? Not from me. Before the contest was launched, Tiny Desk's curated concerts kicked off in 2008. The first four featured artists were all white singer-songwriters. Over the years, Megan Thee Stallion, BTS, and Chris Stapleton made it on. But standards appear to remain different between genres. Underground indie rock, world music, and jazz artists often receive an invite, but only well-established country and hip-hop artists seem welcome. Popular working-class or rural genres like norteño, gospel, hardcore, and cumbia have rarely, if ever, made it to the desk. NPR's leadership is 62% white. The 2023 Tiny Desk concert alternately is judged by four women, four people of color, and two white people. Expanding the curatorial power allows the contest to truly embody its mission of creating an inclusive music community and reaching beyond established industry tastes. Carter, describing how the team gets the word out. The Tiny Desk contest team has beefed up our college and HBCU outreach. We've also been more active on Instagram and TikTok. Happy to say we've seen a significant increase in entries this year. Relying on her experiences as an independent musician and black woman entering the music industry, Giles offers her two cents about breaking into a creative career. One, she says, being intentional about helping others, figuring out what supports them. Also, being aware of your own privilege and how to expand and share that privilege and give resources to others is something that I really want to do. And in particular, with communities of color, knowledge really is power. There's a hunger when you listen to North Carolina artists, Giles states plainly, because we're always the underdog. We have something to prove. Rosa Russ loves watching other entries pour into the contest and plans to reach out and collaborate with other people. That just stretches you and just opens you up to different things. Now, in its seventh year, the Tiny Desk Contest is expanding the contest model, spotlighting top-shelf entries in addition to the sole winner. And Carter says, if this contest gets a musician one step closer to making music for a living, that's a huge win. Well, it's the springtime for Indie Unity Week, and it's Best of the Triangle and Best Awards, which are many, many pages long. They're doing it differently this year. They're separating them by county, and Wake County is the first. And there's hundreds of articles of little snippets of places in here, and I'll only have a chance to read a couple of them just to give you an idea. But you can find the entire list, for Wake County at least, at IndieWeek.com. And I'll just blather on just the name of the winning entry in each category. Best Attorney, Kyra Gibbons. Best Auto Dealer, Johnson Lexus. These are all Raleigh or Wake County. Best Auto Mechanic, Joe at Precision Auto Works. Bridal Store Boutique, Gilded Bridal. CBD and Head Shop, Aloha Plus Cannabinoids. Clothing Consignment, Dorcas Ministries. Dance Studio, CC and Company Dance Complex. Best Dog Boarding, Sweet Paws. Dog Grooming, Wolfgang Bakery and Grooming. Best Dog Training, Sit Meets Sit. Sit means sit. Dog Walking, Pack and Pride. Electrician, Chris Lee Electric. HVAC, Wake Heating and Air. Insurance Company, NC Farm Bureau. Jeweler, Jewelry Store, Bailey's Fine Jewelry. Landscaper, Triangle Environmental. Local Bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. New Business, Longleaf Swine. Best Painters, Anderson Painting. Best Place to Buy Locally Made Artist, Art Space. Best Real Estate Company, Raleigh Realtor. Best Realtors, Autumn Dubois. Best Vintage Store, Father and Sons Antiques. Continuing, Best Art Gallery, Art Space again. Best Art Museum, North Carolina Museum of Art. Comedy Club and Event, Good Nights. Best Drag Show Event, Ruby Deluxe Drag Brunch. Electronic Concert Venue, Red Hat Amphitheater. Film Theater, Alamo Draft House. Local Regional Podcast, North Carolina Food and Beverage. Radio Station, WUNC-FM. Science and History Museum, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Best Theater Company, Raleigh Little Theater. Best Unplugged Concert Venue, The Poor House, P-O-U-R. And best closing music for an Indie Week broadcast is the Indie Week broadcast closing music. Let's hear some of it now. We're honored. We feel very honored. And John Federson will bring this to a close. All of these articles and more you can find and re-examine at your leisure, either on our podcast section for Indie Week or go to IndieWeek.com and you can read everything current, maybe even more current than I'm presenting. So, John Federson for North Carolina Reading Service saying goodbye, and we'll be back with another issue.